It is Monday, January 13th, 2014, and this is episode 50. Wow, 50 of the Defensive Security Podcast. My name is Jerry Bell, and tonight, as usual, I am joined by Mr. Andrew Kellett.
Good evening, Jerry. Good to see you.
Likewise. So, just a reminder, the thoughts and opinions we express on this podcast are ours and do not represent those of our employer. So as is usual, I'm going to start out the podcast with some advice from my friend Bob. He only had one thing, and I think it was because he had that whole incident at the border crossing, but he would like to remind everyone that when you have a vendor come out and work on your hardware, and particularly when that involves replacing defective hard drives, if you have any kind of sensitive data, you may want to somehow, take control of that. You can usually work with your vendors to let you keep the drive or wipe the drive before they leave with it or what have you. But because if your drive, let's say, has PHI or some other sensitive data, when they leave, that's a data breach that's now reportable. And he just would like to make sure everybody understands that that's an important thing. So,
one of my favorite ways of hard drive destruction involves 357s and 223 caliber. That's one of my favorites.
That does not hold a candle to thermite.
True. That is true. I don't have as much thermite on hand is the challenge. But hey, whatever you got at your house.
I'll show you how to make it sometime.
Okay. It's not hard. We're now on another list. Yeah. Thank you. I've got a good one.
Go ahead.
And this is going to come up later. This is late breaking news that my Google Foo uncovered. If you're really, really, really proud of your infrastructure and you let the vendor put out a press release that tells everybody exactly what you're running, that might be a bad idea, because then it tells the bad guys how to target you. Who could that be? Maybe Target. We'll talk about that coming up.
That was a fantastic find.
I'm wondering how long that press release is going to stay on the web.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I pasted in the link that you sent me, and it came back and said this testimonial or this case study is no longer available.
Seriously?
Well, it turns out I messed up the copy and paste.
I was going to say that.
But it got me thinking that it's probably not going to stay up for long. So.
No, but there's, as I was digging further, we'll talk about it when we get to that story.
Sure.
It's a teaser. It's a teaser for the audience.
Get you to stay to the end. All right. So the first story we have tonight for you comes from Information Week, and it is about a new piece of ransomware called PowerLocker. And I know we talked a couple of shows back in the wake of CryptoLocker about how CryptoLocker is a kind of a worst case scenario type of malware. It's pretty well written. It's very effective, and there's almost nothing you can do to undo the damage except for restore from a backup. And at the time, my concern, and I think both of our concern in particular, was this might be an interesting business model for other criminals. And in fact, apparently it is. So this story describes a piece of malware. I guess I would characterize it as kind of turnkey. It's an end-to-end, mass ownage system that lets would-be attackers for $100 buy this this you know, piece of malware that has the, you know, the actual payload that encrypts the hard drive, has the command and control infrastructure, and of course, you know, there's modules you can buy. You know, there's a you can obscure the command website to make it look like a cPanel login. Pretty clear. Not sure why that's worth $25, but hey, you know, this is pretty dangerous stuff. It is really very effective, and I think the only thing that's going to kick the bottom out from this is if people stop paying the ransom. And the only way people are going to stop paying the ransom is if they've got backups. Yeah. Or they stop falling for it, I guess.
Yeah, and I just don't think that's likely. I think people are going to keep paying the ransom. There are some very important files, and you know, this stuff is being written so well that there's not really too many good ways around it. I think people are going to keep paying it.
Yeah, I agree. So I think that the lesson here is, you know, you really, if you aren't already doing it, you probably ought to make sure that, in particular, workstation backups are part of your strategy.
Oh yeah.
Because, you know, I see it too often. Companies kind of put that in the control of their employees.
Or at the very least, you know, and this has its own implications, but look at something like a, you know, like a Mosey or a Carbonite for at least your traveling folks. And that has its own issues, right? You know, from sure, a data leakage standpoint. But can I just say really quick before we move on that my favorite part of this article is, so this was found by a group called Malware Must Die, a group of self-styled anti-malware crusaders, according to the article. This quote had me chuckling. Quote, malware bad actors just keep on coding and developing new threats with a stupid dream to get rich in their stupid heads, the group said in a blog post. I'm like, wow, their PR guy is a six-year-old. That's awesome.
You're a big stupid head.
just like, wow, I don't know what to think about this other than I'm kind of, I don't know, embarrassed to repeat it. But either way, yeah, that's actually how I'm going to talk in my next big CIO conferences. You know, the bad guys and their stupid heads. I think that'll go over well.
It gets the point across, you know.
It does.
Just kind of makes it sink in how bad these people are.
But they're not playing. They're using Blowfish for the symmetric key block cipher, and then they're using 2048-bit RSA. So, I mean, assuming that they are properly invoking these, you know, ciphers, that's huge.
Yeah, properly invoking and generating actual random keys and,
right,
and, you know, not leaking it some way. I think this is a really damaging thing. And by the way, that's not hard to do right. And if you've got somebody that's competent,
true,
man, this is a growth market. And and make sure you have backups. Just dang.
Yeah.
Anyhow. The next story we have for you tonight is one from CSO, and the title is Senior Managers Fumble Security Much More Often Than Rank and File.
I am shocked.
Yeah, this is one of those things that are really intuitive to those of us who have been around the block for a while. You know, I know I've certainly seen it, but, you know, the article is kind of interesting and describes what we probably all have suspected, that the senior managers, senior executives at companies don't believe that the security requirements apply to them, that they are above the fray. And, you know, whether that's because they don't think bad things can happen to them or that they're just simply too busy for, you know, to put up with things that slow them down. You know, they are a risk. But, you know, I thought it was a good article in that it actually not only pointed out the problem, but it also pointed out what kind of counteracts that problem. And really, the only thing that apparently does counteract this is if the top of the company, like the CEO, makes it a priority. So if the CEO has as a, you know, an imperative security, that apparently is a, you know, is something that will counteract this, you know, this philosophy of holier than thou. But otherwise, it's just not a great situation, and you will have executives who you know, who don't think these things apply to them.
Yeah, it's, you know, not only executives, but I see it a lot with sales teams as well, and they have some of the most critical data.
Well, that's true, especially sales, and I think, you know, I've certainly seen this in the past where salespeople are kind of a unique bunch, because if they're making their numbers, they'll get away with a lot of stuff.
That is true, though I'm not a big fan of that philosophy.
Well, I'm not defending it. I'm only...
No, you're correct, though. It is very prevalent. Very, very prevalent.
Especially if you're someone who exceeds your numbers, you know.
Yeah.
I think we've all seen how that plays out. So anyhow, I think the takeaway here is that if you have a problem with this, if you in your organization, the way to approach it, if there is a way to solve it, is to get your top management on board with the program and make sure it's an imperative for them.
Yeah, you need that true executive sponsorship and true support to really be effective on things that change culture and that become a nuisance. Because if your security gets in the way, they'll find a way around it unless they really, really, really support you.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so the next two stories really are kind of the same, and we're wading into the breach of Target. And I'd also point out that it isn't just Target. So Neiman Marcus has come out and said they've been breached. However, apparently they don't know how badly they've been breached. They're still investigating, apparently. And allegedly there are at least three other large name or big name retailers who have been breached. And as far as I've seen, they're not naming who those are yet. So more to come, but anyhow, I think the new news since last time, and I'm sure everybody's probably heard this. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you're sitting on some breach news, now's the time to get it out.
Oh yes. Oh yes.
I'm just saying. Get with the herd on this one.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely.
All right. Go on.
So anyhow. Target has come back and said it wasn't just the 40 million credit card numbers. It also was 70 million records of contact information, names, addresses, emails, phone numbers, you know, stuff like that. 70 million. Wow. That's a pretty significant number. Now, some other news that has come out, the CEO of Target has essentially disclosed, I guess, that the breach resulted from a RAM scraper malware installed on their POS terminals.
Dun dun dun.
Which is kind of what we knew, and you know.
Well, it's what we suspected.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Better way to say
we,
it, right?
We suspected,
especially since the U.S. CERT announcement that came out last week, and you know, we're really interesting timing there. But, you know, that so yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. I saw him on an interview with CNBC, and, you know, they've got good PR crisis management going on. He's saying the right things. He's doing the right, man, it's rough. Now, we've been speculating about how in the world did you own, 1,700 POSs?
Well, 1,700 stores worth of POSs.
Oh, you're right. Sorry. So on average, 20 POSs per store. You know, I'm just making that number up. I don't know if that's accurate, so don't quote me.
Tens of thousands of POS terminals.
Lots. So how do you get your software on this homegrown custom application? And I was doing some Googling today, as I'm wont to do, and what I found was a really interesting little press release from March of 2011 touting the awesome advantage that Target has gained by deploying a completely virtualized Microsoft infrastructure for their entire system, including their POSs, and how they use centralized Microsoft management tools to push patches and updates to all of their 300,000 endpoints, including their POS registers. So I think it's pretty safe to say that there's a very high likelihood that bad guys owned this central management suite and wrote Windows-based malware and pushed it out to everything. We don't know that for sure, but I think that's the safe bet.
Yeah, there's really few other things that actually make sense. You know, how do you get that large of a footprint kind of under the radar? And
yeah,
there really isn't any other logical explanation. And, you know, maybe it wasn't through that particular management tool. Maybe they have others. We don't know, right? But that's kind of, the front runner right now.
You know, the other big unknown for me is how do they exfiltrate the data? That's what the next thing I'd really like to know.
That's a great question because, you know, did the POS terminals have a clear shot to the internet?
That my assumption is even if they did, that would be naive. Not that bad guys aren't naive, but I think the working assumption I'm kind of running with right now is the initial foothold probably was some sort of admin system or server system somewhere. And so if I'm these guys, I'm likely going to bring this data back to this jump host that I've owned and not let the POSs talk directly because that's a huge red flag. But then again, they're Windows boxes, right? So Windows boxes spew a ton of stuff towards the internet all the time.
Yeah, exactly.
So who knows, right? Who knows how locked down these Windows boxes are if they're pretty raw. You know, we also don't know what sort of anti-malware they're running on these Windows boxes or any whitelisting or if the bad guys had to somehow subvert other technologies. Don't know.
If any, you know, they may have been, quote, isolated and not needed anti-malware. You
know, though, interestingly, like I'm just going to pick on Bit9 for a moment because I know them well. One of the things you can do with Bit9, and this is purely administrative choice, so this is not Bit9's fault, this is an administrator's fault, you can say any code that comes from that updater, I trust.
Right.
So I can say, if it came from the centralized Microsoft administration server, I'm automatically going to whitelist it. Now, that's an ease of administration thing.
Yeah.
But guess what? Bites you in the ass.
And so this is similar in, I mean, this hypothesis, I'll say, is similar in nature to what happened in South Korea last year with the Dark Soul attack. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you remember that, but that I think it was 30,000 systems were wiped clean, and the method of propagation was a system management server.
It's not a bad way to go. To be continued, more to learn, but I thought it was pretty interesting to confirm that this is a Microsoft environment. The POS systems are running on Microsoft, and it's all being centrally managed.
Yeah. So there's also probably too numerous to really count. There's a lot of discussion right now going on about the effectiveness of RAM scrapers.
Right. Now, here's the thing. I have never heard a confirmation directly from Target that this was a RAM scraper. I've heard direct confirmation this is a POS-born malware, but I have not heard on the RAM scraper.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I've read quite a few articles that quote the CEO saying something about malware on the POS, and then immediately the article jumps to, and they've confirmed that it's a RAM scraper. Well, you're right. I'm with you there.
I'm not trying to be anal about this. I just want to be really clear about what we know and what we're making conjecture around, so as to not confuse anybody and not to hurt our own credibility. But I want to be clear on that.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a very good point. But it is quite a popular topic in the news stories right now. Every story I read about it makes a comment about the RAM scrapers.
Well, it makes sense as the best place to grab unencrypted data. Now, here's the other thing. We're talking card data, right? all this other information about the profiles of the users, that's probably not sitting on these POS systems. That's probably a separate system somewhere.
Yes.
So this is definitely more than likely a multi... Now, they said they lost both these in the same attack to the same attackers, but clearly this is probably a multi-pronged attack.
My guess, my hypothesis, again, is that the... That data, I would imagine, again, I don't know for sure, but I would imagine it's for things like gift registries and other things. I mean, there's, how do you accumulate 70 million, you know, contact records?
So yeah.
There's probably quite a number, diverse number of you know, ways that they come upon that. But I would imagine it's not as closely protected as credit card numbers, that, and it probably doesn't require a RAM scraper to give, but yeah. I would imagine, again, I don't know for sure, but I would imagine that any given POS terminal probably has the ability to crawl a database, you know, make arbitrary queries against the database, you know, because you could show up at a Target looking to pay your bill or looking to register for something, and, you know, they can, I'm sure they can accommodate you at any one of those registers, which means it has the ability to query a system.
Yeah, because they're not going to distribute that database down to every POS. That's for damn sure.
Exactly.
Yeah. So again, a little bit of conjecture, but I feel pretty safe in these assumptions.
Yeah, yeah. That's what happens when you've been at this too long.
So, you know what they say about assumptions.
Well, that's... Well, it's assume, you know, because otherwise it's you get ass, you, and umptions or something. I don't know.
Munches? What?
Umptions. No. Yeah.
This could be a Cards Against Humanity card.
And in fact, I have one sitting next to me.
That's awesome.
Didn't make it back into the box. So, so anyway, that's... You know, this is going to be a developing story for quite some time, I suspect. My guess is we're going to keep hearing tidbits leaked out every week. You know, I saw Brian Krebs, you know, after the CEO of Target came out, because the Target took some heat about their 4 days. They waited 4 days to come out and publicly acknowledge the breach and whatnot. And so Brian, you know, the CEO gave a timeline, and, you know, it was, I don't remember the exact timeline, but, you know, on day one, they were doing this, on day two, they were doing that, on day three, they were doing something else, and then on day four, they went public. And I saw Brian Krebs tweeted that that's a whole bunch of BS. So I don't know what he knows, but my guess is well, he has some insight on
it's a tough problem, right? I mean, you want to control the data. You want to know as much as you possibly can before it goes public, right? Because it's going to go crazy.
Well, and you want to make sure it's accurate too.
Yeah, right? Absolutely. And this stuff is not something you could just push a button and get a report on. You know, this is complicated, really in-depth stuff. I mean, if you're truly grabbing a piece of malware and reverse engineering it to understand what it did and then tracking down what that did and talking to someone else, that could be weeks to really understand what a piece of malware did. And I don't, you know, they're in a tough spot. And I get that they are getting beat up over not disclosing faster, but, you know, being in this industry, I don't know if that's always even the smartest thing to do, is to disclose immediately until you know more about what's going on and are much more confident.
Yeah. And, you know, obviously before the CEO announced that timeline, my suspicion was that they were working under the direction of law enforcement when it came to, you know, their timeline to announce, because I have seen in the past where law enforcement agencies will request you hold back for a period of time for some reason they consider to be valid.
Yeah.
But, you know, that doesn't seem to be the case here. Although I will tell you, I mean, I've been in this kind of thing a couple of times, unfortunately, and, you know, you don't want to come out with the wrong thing, right? So if, you know, if you think it's 40 million, but it's really 80 million, it would be really bad to come out and say that you had 40 million cards stolen and then have to come back out later and say, no, it was, you know, it was actually 80. Or if it was actually 20 and you think it's 40, you know, you want to come out and give the most accurate information that you can.
Yeah.
Because not doing that is going to hurt you it, one way or the other. I mean, on the off chance you get it right the first time, you know, hey, that's great. But you're probably not going to get it right. And so it only has the chance to hurt you. And I suspect that's probably what their motivation was. I don't know for sure. But, you know, there you have it.
It's true. Preach it.
All right. So the last story we have for tonight is actually something I wrote. So this is slightly different than the normal story we would talk about. And I want to bring it up because it's something that gets under my skin in a bad way. The Twitters and other podcasts and whatnot are all over this story about a teenager in Australia named Joshua Rogers. And Joshua is an enterprising, bright kid, and apparently he happened upon the website of the Public Transport Victoria, which apparently is the transportation provider where he lives, and he discovered a flaw in their website that allowed him access to their customer database, which apparently included names, addresses, and credit card numbers. And where the controversy starts is that PTV, or the Public Transport Victoria, took this person's report, fixed the problem, and then called the police on him. And we've seen this a number of times. Like with first state superannuation, and also in Australia, where somebody had reported a flaw to them, and the police came out and roughed them up a bit, and you know that was an unfortunate situation, but very similar to this. And then of course we all know about Weave, which you know I guess is somewhat related. So anyway, the security industry is really up in arms about this. And the reason being that here we have what essentially amounts to a good guy security researcher disclosing a flaw in a website to the company, and the company's rewarding this person's due diligence and good nature with reporting him to the police. And, you know, there's been articles about the chilling effect on security research and on and on and on. And, you know, I'm going to say I am I'm a big proponent of the concept of security research. And I am I'm against some of the things that have been done, but I can't help but think that people are getting it wrong related to this story. And the reason is that so think about the context here, right? Somebody reported a bug in this website, right? And they had the ability to access all this information, including credit card numbers. So from the perspective of that organization, have you done your due diligence if you accept the word of the person reporting the bug to you that, in fact, you know, they didn't do anything with the data? So if that person did do something with the data and PTV didn't do anything more to investigate, would they be liable? Would they be... would they get a black eye? Could they be sued because of that? So I think we're collectively being a little overly critical of PTV on this, because, you know, I suspect they're doing what they think is the responsible thing for their customers and their shareholders and whatnot in this particular case. You know, this isn't a situation where the person's been accused of a crime. They've apparently asked the police to go investigate if this person did anything with the data. And I think, personally, I think that's a reasonable thing. You know, I don't know, I may be alone in this. Now, since I wrote that, Dave Lewis has actually posted an interview that he did with Joshua Rogers. And I thought it was a little interesting. Apparently, Joshua ran SQL Map on the PTV website. So this wasn't just like, you know, incrementing, you know, a field in the URL by a number. You know, it's a little more than that. Now, so you know, kind of strike one for Joshua, and on the other side, PTV never responded back to Joshua. So kind of strike one on the PTV side. So, you know, there was no back and forth here. So, you know, I don't actually know what PTV's motivation for this was, but I will tell you, if I were in their position, even you know, with the philosophy I have in support of security research, I probably would have done the same thing.
The only thing I can say is you're a monster.
Well, I am a horrible person. Yes.
No, I hear what you're saying. It's definitely an interesting point, interesting story. You know, it's a sad truth, right? You know, you don't pen test without written permission. And I'm not saying he was pen testing at all, but I'm saying in general, you know, it's we've seen this so many times. People don't understand, and no good deed. You know, it's like if you went walking down your street at night and checking for people's open doors and, you know, left the note that, hey, your door was open, that's going to freak some people out. They're not going to like that.
Yeah, and you know, to me, if I go to my bank's website and I see my account number in the URL, and I try changing the account number, and all of a sudden I get somebody else's bank account and I send them an email, I think that's one thing. But if I run SQL Map against my bank's website, that seems to put me into a different ball game, to me at least. And you know, maybe I'm alone here, but
well, his intentions were good in theory.
Right.
It's just the sad part is we have to be careful. With great power comes great responsibility, Jerry.
Yeah. And see, I think that's part of the problem people in the security industry have is that we've seen over and over again the criminalization of you know, quote, hacking, right?
Yeah.
We see it happen quite often, whether it was, you know, Weave and, you know, on and on, the list goes on. But I think that the problem is that there is this perception, and I think it's probably warranted, that people who have the ability to hack are kind of like witches. And you know, they need to be put in their place because they pose a danger to society. And so I think a lot of the security people are really lashing back at that perspective or at that prospect. And so they take a situation like this and say, here, you know, this is yet another example of people who don't understand how important this is. And if it wasn't Joshua Rogers responsibly reporting this, it would be somebody else stealing the data and, you know, doing whatever. But again, I think that from the perspective of PTV, they don't know whether Joshua did or did not improperly use the data. All they know is that he reported the bug.
Right.
And so if I were PTV and I thought about, you know, the prospect of being on in the defense box and saying, you know, trying to answer the question, did you take all reasonable action to make sure that he didn't actually, you know, misuse the data? And, you know, it just seems like a lot more reasonable thing to have Joshua convince the police that he didn't do something wrong than, you know, rely on them convincing me and then have to defend, you know, what makes me qualified to accept his denial. So anyway, you know, that's just my perspective. I suspect I may get some hate mail for that, but hey, you know, won't be the first time.
It's an interesting perspective.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, again, this comes from the perspective of working incident response inside a company. You tend to look at these kinds of things a little bit differently because, you know, you see some of the moving parts that aren't obvious from the outside.
Yeah. So that's a good point. It's a good point.
Anyhow, that's about all we have time for. I've got a time budget today. So, did you have anything else you wanted to bring up?
No. I know I've got to respect your time constraints. This is why children ruin everything, people. Listen to me now. This is why I'm an advocate of 27th trimester abortion.
Dang.
Hey, I'm trying to deflect some of that hate mail that
Thank
you're
going
to get. That's, no.
They'll forget all about me.
I think it will be intriguing to continue to watch the evolution of the Target and other retail implosion.
Absolutely.
Though, to be clear, I think Target will come out of this just fine.
As do I. And, you know, when you look at people like TJ Maxx, you know, there was mm-hmm. there was people calling for their death and predicting their death, and, you know, they're still around. They took a dip, and they bounced back.
The sad part is we are now pretty much training society that this is an unavoidable sort of cost of business.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, it's not the company's fault if somebody smashes through the doors and steals stuff physically. And we're kind of desensitizing people to cyber breaches in some ways.
Well, you know, that's a great point. And it's not only the consumers that we're desensitizing. I think it's the management teams.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because, hey, you know what? TJ Maxx was breached and Target was breached. And holy cow, it can't get much worse than that. And they're still in business. And, you know, yeah, it was painful for a little while. But, you know, think of all the money we'll save if we don't invest in, you know, in security or whatever.
Yeah.
So, boy. You know, I have to tell you, one thing I've been thinking about is as a society, it seems like we need to get to the point where that data isn't useful to an adversary because we're really bad at protecting it. And I don't think that's materially going to change. So, you know, somebody ought to start thinking about the other side of the equation. How do we make it more difficult to use stolen credit card numbers?
Well, we go to what Europe has done, which is, you know, pin and chip.
Yeah, you know, I had a great conversation with someone who's in the anti-fraud of a bank, and they pointed out,
as opposed to the pro-fraud,
opposed to the pro-fraud. Yeah, they pointed out something really interesting that I did not know, and that is, in the U.S., we have invested as an anti-fraud, you know, thing, the concept of you know, the back, we put our anti-fraud technology on the back end.
Right.
Right. And you contrast that with Europe and many other parts of the country that use chip and PIN. They have put the anti-fraud on the front end. They don't have as much invested in back end anti-fraud. And I know this person I was talking to was a little frustrating to them because, you know, it's not like the U.S. has not invested
right.
in anti-fraud. It's just that they have it in a different place.
Well, you know, what's interesting too there is there's actually something to that because you can never trust the endpoint once you lose control of it.
Right.
So if you're trusting security implementation on the endpoint and you don't control the endpoint, you can't trust it. So in some ways, there is a valid philosophical argument that having the anti-fraud in the back end is the right place to have it because it is completely controlled by the banks and the entities that care about minimizing the shrink. As opposed to if you're putting it all on the front end and then explicitly trusting that front end, we know that will end with tears and pain. And, you know, I shouldn't have been so flippant to say we should go to card and, you know, pin or chip and pin because, you know, there are pluses and minuses to that system. And it's also a more expensive system. And really, at the end of the day, this is going to come down to the card issuers of what they want to do because it's really their fraud they're dealing with here. It's their cost more than anything.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's also, it's my understanding that the U.S. is supposed to move over to chip and pin by the end of 2015. But the general consensus is that that's going to come and go, and we won't be anywhere
close. Right up there with a conversion to metric.
well said, my friend. Well said. But
well, I remember. You know, we had all the smart card technology with chips in them in the early 2000s. That was a flash in the pan. It died.
Yes. Yes.
So. You know, it's going to be something that if it's going to happen, it's probably going to be forced by the card issuers for their protection, not because the more free market wants it.
I agree. I mean, I think it's going to end up, especially when it comes to credit cards, because, you know, other than the inconvenience, I've had this discussion a lot lately. Other than the inconvenience of having to get a new credit card and sign an affidavit that some charges weren't yours, and maybe not having an active credit card for a couple of days, which can be troublesome, no doubt. You know, it doesn't hurt you, the consumer. So we, the consumers, are right. Not going to be pushing for some new thing.
Realistically, it could hurt you if it's a debit card and they drain your bank account.
Well, that's why I specifically said
credit card. Yes. You know, not to be flippant about that either. But I'm cognizant of that risk, and I've set up finances to accommodate that problem.
Yes. Right?
I don't let myself get to a situation where somebody accessing my banking account or debit account could screw my life that badly.
Right.
Right. You know, but very, very, very few people have taken the precautions I've taken because, you know, I'm crazy. And I'm going to build a shack on the side of a mountain in Montana and write a manifesto.
Well, you've already got the beard going, so
yeah, well,
you're on your way.
Yeah, I know. All right, you got to go. We got to go.
I got to go.
Our listeners have things to do.
Have Thanks, everybody. Thank you very much. As usual, you can send us feedback. You know, we've been at this now 50 times. I'd really like to hear what you would be interested in for the next 50. You know, if you have any ideas, you know, for format or what have you, send us an email to info@defensivesecurity.org, or you can hit us up on Twitter @DefensiveSec. If you're interested, you can find Mr. Callett on Twitter @Lurg. He posts some cool shit, so, you know. You can find me on Twitter at @MaliciousLink. I don't really post that much cool stuff. And you can find the show in the show notes at the website www.defensivesecurity.org. And as always, if you like the show, give us some feedback, love on iTunes. Tell a friend. You know, we're trying to get our numbers up over 10. We're really close. We're really close.
It's tough since my mom stopped listening.
Yeah, I know.
What are you gonna do?
Anyhow, have a wonderful week, and we'll talk to you again next Monday. Bye.
Bye, guys. Bye-bye.